Ah, hello there. Servus. My name is Haishan Wade, and you're listening to This Week in Geopolitics, where we take a look at the events of yesterday and detail how they paint the geopolitical realities of today. And what do I have for you today? Oops. All Israel. wait. Come back. Please. I swear it's going to be good. But yeah, we're going to be hyper-focusing in on this attack that the Iranians have done on Israel, what it means, and whether or not a wider war will pursue. All that and more coming up. All right, but we'll get into the rapid-fire news before we talk about that. So, Russia has mediated a meeting between Hamas and the PLO. That was the, if I'm not mistaken, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, but I'm going to look that up right now. I know it's in Palestine, but they met up, and this was organized, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. This was organized for talks between Hamas and the Palestinian Liberation Organization for discussions on what a post-war Palestinian government is going to look like. So, that sort of feeling we all got back in October the 7th when this round of fighting started, and you know that gut feeling that you had that I think this time's gonna be different. Now, I'm pretty sure that everyone had this feeling. I don't think there are very few who went into this thinking it was just gonna be just another day in Palestine. This one was big, and I think everybody knew that this time it was going to be different, and it is. So now we're at this stage in the war where you're starting to see the sort of outside diplomatic actors and players, and they're doing things that you would usually see in a paradigm shift style of war. Let me try to put that. A war that sort of punctuates a paradigm shift. There we go. So you think of famous examples being the 30 Years' War and the Peace of Westphalia, which established the legitimacy of nation states, and that nation states were the legitimate sovereign entity of a territory, not just, oh, this roving band of people are their own state. You know, but there's that. There was the, I'm tripping with my words. There was the Congress of Vienna after the Napoleonic Wars, and that established the Napoleonic, well, not the Napoleonic, but the Peace of Vienna. The Peace of Metternich, where the borders of Europe stayed relatively the same, you know, with the exception of Germany and Italy. They unified, but you didn't see much change in the land. Like, the borders in, say, Scandinavia, the borders of Britain, the borders of Spain, France, these all stayed the same, except with small changes, again, that came as a part of the unifications of Germany and Italy, where Germany took a little bit from Denmark and a little bit from France, but nothing really changed in spite of the wars and the conflicts that were fought. I mean, the famous quip is that there wasn't a major war fought in Europe for 99 years from Napoleon to World War II. I almost said World War II, to World War I, which is a blatant lie. The Crimean War, the Franco-Prussian and the Austro-Prussian War, and the Schleswig-Holstein Wars, and the Wars of 1848. Yeah, there were a lot of wars in Europe between Europeans on the continent of Europe. But when the wars ended, they went back, they all defaulted back to the international system that was there when the war started. None of these wars sort of overthrew the international system. And so that is something that can be credited to the system, that it endured so much abuse until World War One, and that was what sort of broke the paradigm. World War One being, again, another war that punctuated a paradigm shift. And 30 years later, you get World War Two, an even bigger war with an even bigger paradigm shift into the modern era. The modern era. I was going to say the superpower era, which I guess is accurate because Russia and United States are superpowers. But now we sit at a precipice where I don't think it's going to be a singular major war that changes the paradigm here with the end of the American era, if you will. Not that America's going to cease to exist, but like this era of America dominating the globe, that's coming to an end. And the era, that's because the end of the empire is nigh. But we're seeing on a sort of smaller scale that sort of war punctuating a paradigm shift happening in Gaza. And when these things happen, you see international agreements but that previously were not on the table. Like, nobody who was in power in Palestine wanted to so much as talk to Hamas. But now, because Hamas has fought this war, and because this war is different, because they have come out as the legitimate force for Palestinian liberation, they have come out as the legitimate force for resistance against Israeli occupation, because they, by way of fighting this war and single-handedly sabotaging Israel was so close. Like, they were within inches. I bet they could taste it. The normalization of relations between themselves and Arabia, which would have been a domino effect throughout the entire Muslim world. I bet they could taste it. And it is only because of Hamas that that did not happen. And therefore, it is only because of Hamas that the idea of a Palestinian state is still on the table. And that by itself, regardless of what we might think of it, regardless of what the Israelis think about it, the fact of the matter is that in doing that, Hamas has emerged as the legitimate entity for a Palestinian statehood and for Palestinian sovereignty, because they saved the prospect of that sovereignty. Because it would have been a done deal. Make no mistake, had they not attacked when they did, it would have been a done deal, because the Saudis would not have gone back on their normalization of relations with Israel had they done so. They wouldn't have done it. In fact, they'd probably be coming out against Hamas. They don't like Hamas. A lot of the leaders of these Arab states and these Muslim states, they don't like Hamas. And they don't want to endorse separatism or terrorism or any kind of militant action like this, independent of a actual state and government, because that would, you know, open up a really nasty can of worms for themselves. I mean, there's a lot of these kinds of rogue actors in the Middle East. They're being dealt with, but they're there. And you don't want to, you know, endorse these kinds of actions against one country, because then someone else can endorse these types of things happening to you. But what happens now, because Hamas attacked, is that the dream, the idea, and I can't stress enough the idea, because right now it doesn't quite exist, the Israelis occupy all of Palestine, but the idea of a sovereign Palestine would have been dead had Hezbollah not attacked. Had Hamas not attacked Israel on October the 7th. So now you're starting to see Hamas start to talk with people who previously would never have talked with them. Russia being one of them. Russia doesn't talk to these kinds of organizations unless they're, brothers in arms against this or that enemy. Like, the Russians have no problem working with Syrian and Iranian militias in Syria against, you know, ISIS. They don't have problems with that, or against the rebels. But aside from being in a common war against a common enemy, Russia doesn't associate themselves with actors like these. No one does, except for us, the United States, because, you know, we kind of train, arm, and equip all of them. Just a thought. But not only the Russians, but the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, they did not want to associate themselves with Hamas. They viewed Hamas as illegitimate because they viewed themselves as the legitimate entity to rule Palestine. But now they have to concede that there would be no Palestine were it not for Hamas. And they also have to concede that they are closer now to the realization of a sovereign, a free and sovereign Palestinian state because of Hamas than they were on their own and by their own actions. And now these forces are starting to meet, they're starting to talk about a post war government. This is sort of like a small-scale Yalta conference, if you will, talking about how you remember how Britain, America, and the Soviets got together a number of times to discuss what the post-war was going to look like in Europe. We're seeing that now play out with the Palestinians. They're talking about a post-war government that's going to include Hamas, where before they would have been excluded, just as an afterthought, just excluded as a instinctual, guttural response. They would have been excluded. Now they're being included, because without them, there is no Palestine. The idea of a free and independent Palestine is dead, and now we're starting to see the consequence, the positive ramifications of their very well-timed act of rebellion, their Hail Mary, if you will, which was very well planned out prior to October the 7th, and the execution was also well-timed to thwart those normalization talks. Because this was planned out at least a year in advance, and the Israelis had the plans. So it wasn't just the normalization, but the timing killed the normalization as well. So this is a pretty major development when we're talking, you know, about the consequences of this war in Palestine. There's going to be a Palestinian state. Everyone's aboard the two-state solution now, and it's just a matter of time until the Israelis lose this fight, you know, literally and metaphorically. And they've already lost diplomatically. I mean, when you have a genocide trial being levied against you in the court, in an international court, you've lost the conversation. You've lost the diplomatic front. And to be frank, it's not like the Israelis were doing themselves any favors either. I mean, I was bewildered by how they just really did not cover their own flank diplomatically, where they would say these wild, outlandish things about wanting to turn southern half of Lebanon into a parking lot. They were going to flatten Gaza. They talked about, one guy talked about nukes. That guy quickly withdrew his comments. But it's like, you're not doing yourself any favors. You're really not, and you're talking about fighting a war with, we're gonna go get Hamas, Hezbollah, Lebanon, Iran, we're going to get all of Iran's proxies. It's like, dude, you're not doing yourself any favors. And I was bewildered by it. And, you know, I sort of just passively accept it now. I mean, it is what it is. They're just not going to cover themselves diplomatically. But it's like, damn, you're not even going to try. But I'll digress. This is a major development. It seems small, but it's a major development, a major step for Hamas. As on the other, because it's we're beginning to see what the end game is for the two sides. And the end game, or I should say the end result is going to be a sovereign Palestinian state where Hamas is going to be a part of the post-war government. And the end result for Israel will either be that of a defeated power or non-existence. And it remains to be seen which one it's going to be. But we'll move on from that. We have a mass stabbing in Sydney, Australia, at a church, no less. Now, this got a lot of attention, and this is why you need guns. Some people would say, well, if people had guns, it would be more dangerous. Well, actually, not quite. I mean, when a shooter, and I'll stand by this point, when a shooter tries to fire off his clip at people in a crowd, he gets dealt with very quickly if the people in said crowd also have guns. I bring this up every time a mass shooting makes the news in the United States and, you know, becomes a big national story. Look at where the mass shooters go, and look at where they don't go, because this would also apply to mass stabbings, if you will. Someone with a knife isn't going to go charge down someone with a gun. So that's number one, right? But then let's say he was a mass shooter instead, because the obvious escalation from being a mass stabber, a loser, if you will, is to be an even bigger loser and be a mass shooter. Look at where the shooters go, look at where they don't go. They go to malls, they go to concerts, they go to grocery store, they go to convenience stores. They might shoot up some guy on the street, do a drive-by, you know. They'll do all that. They'll shoot up a crowd. What they won't do, however, if you'll notice, they won't shoot up the police station. They won't shoot up a military base. They won't shoot up City Hall or the governor's mansion. They won't do it. They won't touch those places. Why? Because they know that there's armed security. They're not going to go somewhere and shoot it up if they know that they're going to be shot at. Shooters don't like being shot at, which is why we need more gun ownership in the United States. We need more gun ownership. That's the actual real cure for mass shootings in the United States. Mass gun ownership in the United States. That's the solution. And mass gun ownership would do... have the added effect of deterring mass stabbings as well. So I've come back to the stabbing here in Sydney. The Australians need guns, and that's the real thing here. I mean, forget men with knives. I mean, have you seen the animals that live over there? Why do you not have guns? I mean, you lost a war to emus when you had machine guns. You'd think that you would have learned your lesson after that one. But yeah, this is a tragedy. This is a tragedy. These people didn't need to die. This guy is clearly sick in the head, but there's always going to be sick people in society who get bright ideas about trying to kill people, which is why the people need to be able to protect themselves with the maximum force available. Now, do you need nukes? Perhaps not. That'd be sort of the maximum force available, you know. But a gun would save lives. Guns save lives because it may seem oxymoronic, but it lets you take the life of people who are trying to take yours. And why should you be the one to die when the person trying to kill you, they could die instead? It's a sort of blunt, harsh reality of the world, but if someone's trying to kill you, they've forfeited their right to live. And you have to think about yourself. You have to think about your family. Don't let someone else take your future from you because they had a moment. Don't let someone else take your future from you because they crashed out, right? And I'll leave off on that point. But hopefully things like this stop happening in the future. But that would require, again, the people to be armed. In other news, we have Donald Trump shifting his position on Israel just a little bit. He's still taking the, I'm super duper pro-Israel, you know, they have to toe the line. But I was hesitant about his foreign policy, listening to him before, because when the shit went down before, he was like, oh, I would have done this. It would never happen under me. We would have done that. Da, 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 da. And I'm like, oh, okay. We're supposed to be America first now. Nah, that's Israel's not America. Nah. We're supposed to be keeping America out of wars, not jumping in just because it's Israel. And I'm not making exceptions just because it's Israel. And so I was not very satisfied with his position at the beginning of the war. But I'd still vote for him because of everything else he would do. But now he's shifted his position towards a much better point on the spectrum, where now he's sort of taking the same approach to the Israel-Palestine war that he's taken with the Russo-Ukrainian war, which is that he's talking about negotiating a peace. And that single act alone, just by uttering those words, he's now completely outflanked the entire Biden administration diplomatically. And again, these are supposed to be the adults in the room. The adults are back. Remember when they committed that coup against Trump and got him out of office? You know, the adults are back. Oh, America's back, and look at where they got us. This guy who they tell us we're gonna be in World War III if we're with this guy. We have never been. Every other day, it's, are we gonna be in World War III? We're gonna be in World War III. This is all Biden. It's all him and his handlers who. Whoever's pulling the strings behind that curtain, God bless them. I know it must be such a tedious work. I'd never want that job. I mean, I'd rather just run the damn country myself. But all this talk of how Trump was going to get us into World War III, and we've never been closer than we have been under this Biden guy. Like, goddamn. War in Ukraine, and we're against Russia, we're doing all these provocations, and Taiwan against China, and the big one over the weekend, oh my god, is Israel gonna drag us into war with Iran? Oh my god, it's World War III, and you know, look, that's all Biden, bro. that's all Biden, bro. No new wars under Trump. And this guy, look, I'll give him credit where credit's due. He followed through on the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But this guy, this is the World War III candidate. It's my goodness. But yeah, they all this talk of how Trump was the bad guy. Trump is going to get us into this mess after this mess after this mess. The tariffs aren't going to work. It's going to raise prices by triple, double, quadruple. And what actually happened was America started to prosper. America didn't get into any new wars. And not only that, which is sort of a bare minimum as a president, not only that, but this guy negotiates a ceasefire with the Taliban, walks across the DMZ 4 times in one day without getting shot, shakes hands with Kim Jong-un. And he was going to get a deal with Russia, going to get a deal with China. They had to sabotage him. He was going to get us out of Syria. They had to sabotage him. Like, win after win after win. Like, he was not lying when he said, well, that was the one lie he ever told me, that I'd get tired of winning. I never got tired of winning. I was happy. That was the only lie that man told me. But just think of all those accomplishments. And think of how it took Trump to get those. And how these experts, all these experts who are just so smart and intelligent and who think strategically, couldn't do anything. Couldn't do anything. And so, and here we have yet another display of the difference, right? All the experts are talking about war with Iran and having panic attacks about war with Iran because they won't withdraw the blank check that they've given Israel. And now they thought that giving Israel a blank check was a good idea. They thought that giving Ukraine a blank check was a good idea. These people don't know strategy. And ironically enough, they could learn a lot about grand strategy by studying Russia, by studying China. But even more than them, since they love the military side of strategy, they love the military side of strategy. So we'll pick a country that they could really learn something from. And that's Iran. I've said it a couple times in the past, but when I was sort of just observing how Iran was sort of navigating the turbulent times in its region, how it had gotten alliances, Iran is an example of a masterclass in grand strategy, real grand strategy, serving real national interests with alliances and commitments that actually benefit your country, right? Because the Iranians are not America. They don't live an ocean away from their problems. Alliances and these types of things are much more important for them, especially when they're at war, because they're always at war with America and Israel, and by proxy, Europe. They're always at war. So how do you fight that war? Well, you don't fight it alone. You fight it with every... That they managed to pick the winning side. They backed the winning side in every conflict without fail in the Middle East. That's impressive. Because we backed the losing side in every conflict. All of these same conflicts, we were backing the losing side. Iran backed the winning side. And now that the winners are on top, Iran has strong and capable allies who are hostile towards us. Precisely because all those countries and all those actors and players in the region had to fight us in their wars, in their conflicts. The Houthis had to fight us and Saudi Arabia. Assad had to fight us. The Iraqis and the militias there had to fight us. They're still fighting us. Hezbollah, Lebanon, they had to fight us. They had to fight Israel. Iran backed the winning side in every single conflict in their region, and now they stand at the top as the dominant power of the Middle East. The dominant power of the Middle East. Now, outside powers are stronger than themselves, Russia, China, United States, but in the Middle East, they are king. they are the most powerful nation in the Middle East, aside from perhaps Turkey. And, you know, that's a that one's a big, big competitor, but they've always been competitors. Even back to the days of Rome and, you know, and Byzantium. The Ottomans were even rivals with the Persians as well. This is sort of a regional rivalry that just stems from geography. But the Iranians know strategy. Trump knows strategy. These experts know nothing. And again, it's just another example. Just another example of how Trump's talking piece, he outflanked the entire administration on this. And it's a much better position, quite frankly, to be talking about peace between Israel and the other side. Instead of this, I'm so pro-Israel, no one's more pro-Israel than me. It's like, this is not a competition for who's more pro-Israel. Like, this is the American presidency you're looking to gain here. And I just, you know, it irked me for a while, and it still irks me listening to people talk about how, you know, go through that whole purity test of, I love Israel. I love Israel so much, but I just think that this isn't right for them and America. And, you know, I don't like watching people who don't need to have any affiliation with this sort of pick sides in a conflict and then simp for the side that they've picked. And it's like, just stop it. And I'm happy that Trump is, I can't quite say he stopped simping, but he's come a lot closer to not simping for Israel, that he's willing to put his foot down and say that we are the dog, you are the tail, we wag the tail, not the other way around. Because Biden, he lets the tail wag the dog all the time, which is why we're wagging all over the fucking place. But Trump's talking about peace, and that's an objectively better position to be in. Granted, I'm not entirely sure if he's even going to have the opportunity. Like Ukraine, I'm not entirely sure he's even going to have the opportunity to negotiate this. I'm sure that he could, right? It's not that I doubt that he could. Like, the time frames, I can do it in 24 hours. Okay, we all know it wouldn't happen in 24 hours. But it would happen relatively quickly. And that's the point. That it would happen relatively quickly because he would use his leverage. I just don't think he would have the opportunity. Because I don't think Ukraine is going to exist as a country by the time he comes back to power in January. And at the rate things are going, Israel might be alive as a country. But, I mean, we're halfway through April. But there's still a long way to go. But Israel is on a path to suicide. And it's only been almost 7 months that they've been at war. And I don't know, because the escalation gets more dangerous by the month. They just tried to instigate a war with Iran, and thank goodness the Iranians had a modicum of common sense to them, because they had every reason to just slap Israel around, but they chose not to, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. They had every reason to slap Israel around, they chose not to, but the Israelis are trying to start a bigger war. But a bigger war is exactly what will kill them as a nation. And it's just, Israel's on borrowed time. With the current leadership that they have, Israel's on borrowed time. And it's just ironic listening to people, because I just watched this Piers Morgan show where he had Cenk Uygur and a couple other panelists on debating the Israel-Iran situation. And they're all talking about regime change in Iran and, you know, all this stuff. Ironically, the problem isn't the regime in Iran, it's the regime in Israel. And that's just a massive irony that we're talking about regime change against the country who's been a force of restraint in this war. And we're talking about keeping and preserving and protecting the regime in Israel, who is the root cause of the fucking problem. But what can you do? All these Israel simps. Israel's losing popularity in the United States, and Cenk made a point to point that out. And he's right. At never at any point could anybody have ever imagined that Israel would be losing support in the United States across the board, right and left. Oh, but don't worry, America's so divided. Yeah. But it's just really ironic. It's just really ironic. I'll put it that way. And I'll leave that almost there, because last but not least, Hezbollah has fired at least 50 rockets at Israel, most of which were intercepted. Just another piece of Israel's air defense that's been chipped away because they can't replace those air defense missiles. This was a smaller attack that came prior to the big attack. And we're going to talk about the big attack now. Right now, because the big story of the week, and we'll still be just hyper-focusing on this one for the rest of the episode. And I think I have something else I'll talk about if I can get to it. But yeah, big story. Last week, we talked about Israel bombing the Iranian embassy, specifically the consulate in Damascus, which is in Syria. Everybody knew that Iran had to respond. Everybody knew it. Everybody knew it. Everybody who was rational and everyone who was sane. Some people think that Israel is allowed to attack whoever and whatever they want, and that no one who gets attacked by Israel should ever respond and ever attack Israel back. A really childish worldview. But we live in an era of people with childish worldviews. There was that famous quip from a Britishman, I forget who it was, in World War II, where they were talking about Hitler, and he entered this war under the childish assumption that he was going to bomb everyone else, and that no one was going to bomb him. That's literally Israel. They and their simps operate under the childish assumption that Israel and the United States can bomb anybody that they want, whenever they want, wherever they want, and that no one will bomb them. Now, granted, you have to go really far out of your fucking way to bomb the United States, but thankfully, we have thousands of American troops right at your doorstep that you can bomb instead. So have a feast, you know. We're gonna back up Israel and everything that it does, and then share in the consequences of their stupid actions, you know. Because why wouldn't we want to share in their suffering when we could, I don't know, not? But alas, everybody knew Iran had to respond to this attack on their consulate, their embassy. They had to respond. It's not a matter of wanting to or not. It's a matter of the precedent. It's a matter of the principle. You can't just attack our embassy and get away with it. It's the principle that they had to respond. Because if they didn't, that would mean that every embassy that they have that is in not necessarily friendly places around the world, that's just free eats. Oh, the Iranians, they're not going to defend their embassy. Well, we can do whatever we want. That's a terrible precedent to set. We would never let that happen to our embassy. The Israelis wouldn't let it happen to their embassies. But for some reason, the Iranians are expected to let it happen to theirs. And there's a really strong double speak and a really strong hypocrisy when it comes to Iran. Because what a lot of these Israel simps don't realize when they talk about how Israel has to respond and establish deterrence, they don't realize that everything that they say applies both ways, and that Iran also has a right to exist. Iran also has a right to its own sovereignty. And Iran also has a right to retaliate and respond when they are attacked. All these arguments you heard from the Israel simps about how they have the right to respond, they have the right to do this, that, and the third, because Hamas, the savage barbarians, they attacked and they killed all these people. Well, that goes both ways, but they don't think about that. They do not think about that. They don't want to think about that. Their job is to simp for Israel. Their job is to give them money and never get laid. But yeah, it goes both ways. Iran had to respond. Now, Iran eventually did respond. I mean, they took a moment, right? They took a moment to sort of gather their bearings. They put their forces on high alert. Soldiers in the Revolutionary Guard were put on temporary. They were temporarily banned from taking leave, right? They were essentially locked into the force, and they closed the airspace over Tehran, which is the capital of Iran. And for a good minute, there was a lot of speculation over when they would attack and how they would do it. How big would the response be? Would it be conventional military or would it be asymmetrical? Because Iran usually don't do the tit for tat militarily. They really like their asymmetrical warfare. Whenever they have the chance, they like to use the asymmetrical responses, and you know it was them, but you can't. It's an active war. You can't really do it. That's how they like to usually operate. But this time, they chose the conventional approach. But just going back to the confusion that was present in the air for over the course of the weekend. There were a lot of questions being asked about what Iran's response would look like. The U.S. government was they were threatening war with Iran if they attacked Israel. It's like, and there is the hypocrisy, which has been put on full display, especially since the attack happened itself. But it's like, Israel attacks our embassy, and we're threatening Iran. Israel attacks an embassy. Right, this is the no-go zone. If there was ever a no-go zone, it is the embassy of another nation. Well, that and, you know, that and refugee camps. But how are you supposed to be able to tell those refugee camps from Hamas campsites? I mean, yeah, come on now. How did we really know that embassy was an Iranian embassy? How do we know it wasn't a Hamas embassy? It's like, you know. I'm being a little bit facetious here, but there are no-go zones. Like, you can violate a humanitarian aid mission. You can bomb a humanitarian aid convoy. You can bomb a refugee camp. You can bomb it over and over and over again. You can bomb hospitals. What you can't do is bomb an embassy, because now you're getting another nation involved in your conflict, right? Directly. That embassy, the land that embassy is on, is legally the land of whoever the embassy is for. You bombed Iran when you bombed their embassy. That's how it works. Iran had to respond, but yet Israel bombs an embassy, and we're coming out simping for them, saying, hey, don't you respond, Iran? Biden. Mr. Biden. What are you gonna do if Iran? What message do you have to say? What do you have to say about Iran attacking Israel?
Don't.
it's stupid. It's like you're out with your girl, and she goes and slaps someone across the fucking face, and then splashes her drink all over that person. Now, that person has every right to knock her the fuck out. But you're sitting there like, don't you do it. Don't you respond. Hey, come on, don't you do it. Now, granted, you should protect your female. You should protect your significant other. But your significant other shouldn't put you in situations like that. And that's the other half of this equation. Israel puts us in these types of situations. The appropriate response is not to sit there and go, don't you do it, don't you respond. No, it's to grab that bitch and walk away from the situation. De-escalate. We're not doing anything of the sort. We're just sitting there going, don't you do it. Don't you do it, please. Don't do it. It's so unserious. It's so unserious that it's almost embarrassing if I didn't expect it out of these people. But yeah, we knew Iran had to respond. We knew the United States was going to simp for Israel. We knew Israel was going to be shocked at the very concept of having accountability for their actions. but it really doesn't help that Biden went and gave another blank check to Israel. Another thing that I'll observe before we get into what happened with the attack, the Iranian response, because in that moment, there was a lot of confusion, but at the same time, oddly enough, there was a lot of clarity as well. Like, in that moment, just for a moment, I think a lot of people's eyes were opened to just how many options were available to Iran if it wanted to go to war with Israel. Cyber attacks, missile attacks, drone strikes, ballistic missile attacks. Oh, they could flatten this city here or there. They could get all their militias, all their proxies to launch coordinated assault. They could do this. They could do that. For a very brief moment, there was some clarity about just how strong Iran is and the things that Iran could do if it wanted to. Although not enough clarity to realize that they don't want to do that in most circumstances. But those in the middle of that confusion, in the middle of that storm, in the eye of that storm, was some clarity. It didn't last very long, right? It didn't last very long, but I did notice it, right? And maybe you noticed it as well. But yeah, a bit of clarity in the midst of all that confusion. But now the attack has happened. Iran has responded. Right after the underestimation of Iran, that sort of veneer of they're too inferior to really do anything, right as that, you know, slipped, that mask we put on slipped for just a moment, and we saw what the Iranians were capable of, the Iranians responded. They fired a very large contingent of drone and cruise missile strikes towards Israel. I say cruise missiles. There were a handful of cruise missiles. It was mostly drones and rockets fired towards Israel. Now, the numbers range from over 100 to around 300. We'll just run with 300. You know, that seems like an appropriate number, right? I would go with a lower number if I wasn't convinced, and you know I would. But I think 300 is a good number to work with, so I'll believe that one. The Iranians haven't contradicted it either. Granted, not that they would, but it's the high end of the spectrum, 300. But I think now, because I was sort of reserving my judgment in the heat of the moment, now I think we can probably safely say that 300 drones and rockets and missiles were fired at Israel. That seems like an appropriate response for a bombing of your embassy. And yeah, most of the drones and the missiles were intercepted. So that we'll just get that out of the way right at the start. Most of the drones and missiles were intercepted. U.S. CENTCOM, the Central Command, they claim to have helped Israel shoot down at least 80 of these rockets and drones. At least 80 drones and 6 missiles. That was the number that I got at the time that I was looking for numbers on how many of these rockets went through. So there was U.S. assistance here in the shooting down of these rockets that were going into Israel. And you could see the videos of the Iron Dome. It's actually really impressive watching. I'll give them that. It's really impressive and satisfying to watch the Iron Dome at work. Granted, for every missile that you don't hit, that's a rocket that someone's going to have a really bad day for every one of those rockets that you miss. Now, Israel shot down about 99% of these. I think only a handful, like I'm talking single digits. I think only like single digits actually made it to the ground in Israel and hit targets. And one of the targets, I have it. Where is it? Because it hit one base. The Nevatim base in Israel was one of the places that the Iranian missiles actually reached. So 99%+ of this was shot down, which is good. Well, we don't want anyone to die here. And the Iranians, I don't think the Iranians really wanted anyone to die. And I'll talk about that. But yeah, big attack on paper. All of it shot down. Only a handful actually reached their targets. So that happened, right? That happened. And one of the biggest consequences, if we're looking at this purely from a cost-benefit ratio, one of the biggest consequences that I sort of picked up on right away was the fact that this is another chip. This is a chunk taken off of Israel's air defense systems. Because remember, 50 rockets were just fired from Hezbollah earlier this week. Now you're talking 300 drones and missiles fired from Iran. Now, 80 of those were, you know, about a third of the rockets were, the Israelis had U.S. assistance in shooting them down. But that's still 200, or at a bare minimum, 150 rockets that they have to shoot down on their own, right? That means 150 Iron Dome missiles that are no longer available in the event of an attack. And the Iranians just threw 300 at you as a slap on the wrist for attacking their embassy, right? And that's another thing. Another thing. Iran didn't actually want to do any damage. And that's sort of what I would deem it self-evident by how slow and easy to intercept these rockets were. I mean, sure, you can overwhelm and oversaturate the Iron Dome, but 300 rockets and missiles over the course of a 5-hour-long attack, that's not oversaturation of an air defense system. Unless you do that, you have 300 missiles coming in for 5 hours, you know, and then you do that for the next 5 hours, and then the next 5 hours, and then the next 5 hours. You know, if you were to do it like that, that would be a longer-term oversaturation, but if you really wanted to oversaturate the air defenses, you'd have sent these 300 drones and missiles and compressed it into the space of like an hour, right? Or even 30 minutes if you could manage to fire that many all at once. That would oversaturate the air defenses, that would overwhelm them, that would allow you to take them out with these drones and rockets. If Iran wanted to do that, they could have, and they would probably still have a lot of rockets left over to just bomb other military installations in Israel, because I don't think that they would go out of their way to bomb civilians. Granted, when you're dealing with dummy rockets like this, it's really easy to hit an apartment building, so. But that didn't happen. Again, because they fired 300, 300 got shot down. Thank goodness. But Iran wasn't trying to deal any serious damage. But in light of this, in light of that, there's been this strange attempt to sort of paint Iran as the one escalating the entire... And I sort of alluded to this earlier when I talked about this, the childish assumption that Israel's going to bomb everybody and no one's allowed to bomb them. There's this strange attempt to paint Iran as the one escalating here when, how dare they fire these rockets at Israel? Oh my God, the Israelis need to respond, which just ignores the fact that the idea that the Iranians are the ones escalating here, when the entire reason that they carried out this attack was because Israel bombed their embassy in Damascus, is incredible to me. And I mean that literally. It's incredible. I can't fucking believe it. But Iran gets attacked. Iran responds in the most light-handed, telegraphed, and easy-to-handle way. But Iran is the problem. Iran needs to be retaliated against. Israel needs to assert... They need to assert their deterrence over Iran when they were the ones who started the problem. It's childish. It is childish. It is the epitome of childish. And we shouldn't give it any more legitimacy than that. It is childish. And it is warmonger-ish. It is hawkish. To say that Israel needs to respond, that's the worst thing they could do. It's also baffling watching all these supposedly pro-Israel, oh, I love Israel so much, no one's more pro-Israel, you know, all the Israel simps and the people who pay lip service to the Israel simps, who'll say, no one's more pro-Israel than me, oh, I'm so pro-Israel, you know, all this talk about being pro-Israel, and this is why I titled that episode early on in October. This is why I titled that episode Israel and All Her Fake Friends, right? Because all I love Israel. I just want Israel to do something that is objectively bad for it to do. I love Israel so much that I want it to commit national suicide. That's what these people tell you. That's what these people are saying. When you look at the consequences of what these people are advocating for, you realize that they're advocating for the self-destruction of Israel. It's mind-blowing. But that's what they do. And that's why I titled that episode, Israel and All Her Fake Friends. If they had half an ounce of sense, they would realize that going along with these ideas, not that they're necessarily influenced by commentators in the United States, but it's not the commentators, it's people in positions of power who are espousing these same stupid ideas. Israel has a lot of fake friends, right? And I am no Israel simp. I do not give a goddamn about Israel. But it's astonishing to see that my position, which is a total apathy towards them, that says the United States shouldn't be in their war, good luck, all right? We're just not going to be over there. To think that that position has managed to become more pro-Israel than what the Israel simps are churning out from their mouths is incredible to me. It is isn't it? Isn't that incredible? Like, they're talking about starting a chain of escalation with Iran, right? It's like, Israel attacks Iran. They ignore that, and they want to hyper-focus on Iran bombing Israel back, but they haven't even actually bombed Israel. They sent 300 of the slowest, most easy-to-hit rockets and dummy drones that they had in their arsenal. And then, as I was able to get more information on the attack, they had apparently warned that this was going to happen like 72 hours in advance. The rockets took hours to fly from Iran to Israel because these were all launched from Iran. So it's a first in that this is the first attack on Israel that Iran has conducted from Iranian soil. And I'm pretty sure that's sort of the point. You bombed our soil, so now we're going to attack you from our soil. And the symbolism of it is meaningful, considering how we got here. But this is, again, the most telegraphed, easy-to-stop, light-handed response that Iran could have done that would still be politically acceptable within Iran. Because, you know, the domestic politics also plays a part. And you have these insane people who are saying that this is the worst thing ever and Israel needs to reestablish deterrence because we can't let Iran get away with this. Get away with what? Get away with what? Not actually bombing you? Not actually oversaturating your air defenses? Taking a political W at home while militarily actually taking an L? Taking an L militarily, well, it's a symbolic L more than anything else. It's not that they couldn't do worse. They can. And everyone knows that they can do worse. And if they wanted to, they would have done worse. And everyone knows that. So they went as the absolute minimum. They went as hard as they needed to at the absolute minimum for it to be politically acceptable inside of Iran. But it was so light-handed that Israel was able to just slap it away and go on about its business. Both sides can claim victory. Iran fired 300 rockets and drones at Israel, and they can say, we did that. We made them deplete all these, their billions of dollars worth of air defense missiles to fight these rockets off. We made them weaker militarily, and we got them back for the bombing of our embassy. All right, that's a win for Iran at home. It's a very small win, but it's one that they can take, and they're trying to take the win. Israel, who shot down 300 rockets and drones, doesn't want to take the W, because it's a win for both sides here. Both sides can take this and legitimately claim a victory, especially the Israelis, because they shot down 300 rockets and drones. And they can now de-escalate with Iran. But you have these fake friends, these Israel whisperers, who love Israel so much that they want Israel to turn down the opportunity to not have a war with Iran, turn down the opportunity to focus, to go back to focusing solely on Gaza, which, we're supposedly supposed to believe that Iran, that Israel, excuse me, is destroying Hamas. Well, focus on the task at hand. That's your objective in this war, not a war with Iran. Focus on the task at hand, if that's what you're actually doing. All these Israel whisperers want Israel to sacrifice an opportunity to not have a war, which would distract them from what they're actually trying to achieve in Gaza. A war that they can't win, mind you. It's insane to me. It's insane. And they all know, and they all like to fearmonger about, oh, if Iran comes into the war, that means war with Hezbollah, that means war with the Houthis and all these, and the Axis of Resistance. It's like, okay, well, why would you want to instigate a war with Israel and Iran then? If you know that that's going to be a consequence of them being at war with Iran, why would you do that? Fake friends. Israel. My Israeli brothers. Do not listen to these fake friends, all right? Don't listen to they're going to get you killed. They think that they are the moral superiors. They think that they have the high ground. They think that they're so smart. If you listen to them, you will die. And that's not an exaggeration. Your country will die listening to these people. And I beg of you, don't listen to people in your own country who espouse these same ideas. It doesn't matter where the ideas come from. It's going to get you the same result. You might not exist as a nation listening to ideas like this. Take the W and walk away. Take the W and walk away. And when you get the chance, do it with the Palestinians. Take the W and walk away. And do it on your own terms. Because if you don't do it on your own terms, you're going to be doing it on the terms of the United Nations. You're going to be doing it on the terms of the Arab states. And those terms, you're going to choke on them. You're going to choke on those terms. No one's going to want them, but you're not going to have a choice. That's what happens when you're a defeated power. Do not let these people talk you off the cliff into becoming a defeated power when you still have the opportunity, the option, to walk away from this as a victor and claim a legitimate victory. Both sides are in a position where they can claim a victory, which means that both sides are in the opportune position for de-escalation. Do not listen to these fools who want you to continue the path of escalation into a hot war with Iran. When you can see that the Iranians, if they want to, can oversaturate your air defenses by just firing off hundreds of rockets at you. You saw Hezbollah fire rockets at you before this attack. Do you really want to be fighting both of them at the same time? That's not a winning strategy. It's just not. Don't do this to yourselves. This is my plea. This is my plea to you. Don't do this to yourselves. Don't let these idiots talk you off the cliff. It's like you're trying to commit suicide. You're on the top of a building, and these people who are supposed to be your friends are asking you to walk off. Jump, they say. No, don't jump. Walk off of the ledge. That's what you should do. Walk off of the ledge. Take it from me. I'm a professional in not killing myself. But that's my plea to you. All right, that's my plea to you. Another thing that I wanted to get into was some of the analysis, because I wanted to share Scott Ritter's analysis on the strike that happened, the Iranian response, because I think it's spot on. And I agree with a lot of what he says the implications are, and it sort of opened my eyes to a couple things as well. So I'm referencing here, I'm referring to the interview that Scott Ritter did with George Galloway. He was on George Galloway's show, and George Galloway is the guy who just won a parliament seat in Britain. Upset election, beat out both the parties. So he's a big boy now. But I'll refer you to that interview. I think it came out today. So Scott, he talked about Iran's strike, and he talked about how it worked using decoys and dummy rockets, which would, they didn't really have an actual payload, but they were just flying out to draw out the Iron Dome missiles. And he brought up something that I noticed myself. I talked with you guys about it just a minute ago, about how slow these rockets were. Because Iran has real ballistic missiles. Real missiles, like that move in the way you would expect them. Not like a rocket, right? Where it floats, where it sort of hovers through the sky, like a bumblebee. No, like we're talking a wasp, and go, you know, something that really moves when you fire it, right? They have those, right? So it's like, when you're seeing this attack, it's like, well, okay, those seem to be moving really slow. Like, and it doesn't seem like the footage is sped up in any way, most of it ain't. So when you see the rockets, you're like, well, okay, those are pretty slow. And I guess it's, I think the only reason I noticed how slow they were is because I've gotten accustomed to seeing fucking these super duper fast rockets and missiles that you get with the Russian war in Ukraine. And those babies move with some impunity, with some meaning. And so I think that's the only reason I noticed that they were moving so slow. But Scott Ritter made the observation as well. These are not actually intended to do any real damage. And if they were, they wouldn't be so slow. The Iranians wouldn't have telegraphed it 72 hours in advance. They wouldn't have fired off these extremely slow rockets. And yeah, they wouldn't have given you the advance warning and then fired the slowest munitions they had to give you all the time in the world to prepare your defenses. Right, if your goal is to inflict any kind of pain on somebody, if you were trying to inflict maximum damage on Israel, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't warn everybody in advance. You wouldn't tell everybody about it. You wouldn't tell everybody when it's gonna happen. You wouldn't tell them how you're gonna do. Especially how. You definitely wouldn't tell them how you're going to attack them. You could tell them where and when. But if they don't know the how, you could still get them pretty badly. If you're at war, the how is very important. But to tell them how, on top of where and when, you're not actually trying to do anything harmful. You're just not. That's not a serious attempt on the lives of Israelis. And I observed this, Scott observed this as well. They warned hours in advance of this attack. You wouldn't do that. He also highlighted the vast cost differential in firing these rockets at Israel versus Israel shooting them down. And this was, excuse me, this was actually something that I really sort of, it flew over my head, no pun intended, that the costs involved in these rockets, because in the back of my mind, I'm like, I know that the Iron Dome is really expensive. I know that it's more expensive to try to shoot a rocket out the sky, especially if you're trying to do it with another missile. And this is sort of prior knowledge I had from learning about America's ballistic missile defense systems, you know, which is supposedly meant to stop nuclear weapons. But I don't know, in the age of hypersonic missiles, I don't know how much good that one's going to do us now, especially when it was like 50-50 on a good day with normal missiles. But it's really hard to do that. It takes much more advanced targeting systems on the interceptor missile than it does to fire a rocket and let it go to its target. And thus, you get a really big cost differential when you factor in that you need the radars to detect the thing, versus, you know, I can just hook I can just hook my missile up to a GPS and fire it, and if it's manufactured half decently, it's gonna get to its target. That's cheap, right? Or better, I can fire a rocket that I know has X amount of range. I can angle the rocket tubes. There we go. I can angle them in the rocket rails in whatever angle that I want, such that it's gonna get that maximum range or whatever range that I want it to. I can, you know, if you've ever played a physics related game, when you try to fire the catapult or the trebuchet and you see the path that it travels on, you know, you can do that. And it's really low cost, and it doesn't take much. It doesn't take a lot of computing power to make that happen. With an interceptor missile, it takes a lot of computing power. You need to be able to fire it on short notice. You need to have radars ready to find the missile that you're going to shoot at, and then you have to be able to lock onto it and stay locked onto it long enough for your interceptor missile to actually hit the target. That's just explaining it. You can see how that's going to be much more expensive. But it didn't really click with me how expensive it would be. Scott Ritter sort of laid it out very briefly. He said, Iran spent millions firing rockets at Israel. Israel spent billions shooting them down. So I took a moment to sort of look up the cost of these missiles. And Iron Dome, I'll start with the rockets. So I looked up how much one of Hezbollah's rockets cost. Because if Iran's using drones and these kinds of slow-moving rockets, it's probably comparable to what Hezbollah would fire, right? Hezbollah's rockets cost them about $400 a pop, which is incredible bang for your buck. So let's just go ahead and triple that for Iran's rockets, right? Let's just go ahead and triple that to a cool $1,200 per rocket. You know, and let's just assume the drones cost as much to make the numbers easier for me, because, you know, I like easy. So that's 1,200 times 300 rockets. That's $360,000 that they spent on this attack just on the rockets themselves. And of course, then there's the rocket system, fielding it, and the cost of firing it, and using the you know, the navigation system and all that. You know, so there's other costs involved, right? The full cycle, because the cost of the troops themselves, militaries cost money. So we'll just round that $360,000 up to about $1 million. But for 1,200, you know, I'm just throwing numbers out here. But Israel's Iron Dome missiles, those babies cost between $40,000 to $50,000 up front for each missile. $40,000 to $50,000 for each missile, and then when you factor in the costs associated with actually using the missile, it climbs up. And this is Wikipedia, so take it for what it is. The cost will climb up to $150,000. So I just rounded that down to $100,000. The cost per interception is $100,000 plus for each rocket you intercept. And Scott Ritter very accurately pointed out that is an unsustainable equation. The math does not work in Israel's favor. So we take, you know, $40,000 per rocket. We'll take, you know, the low end of that estimate. And the cost per interception is $100,000 and above, so actually we can work with $100,000 for each interception. So $40,000 for the rocket, $60,000 for the targeting, basically. Israel intercepted how many rockets from Hamas and yes, because this isn't the first time they've been having to deal with these rockets. But they intercepted how many rockets from Iran and Hezbollah? 300 rockets from Iran and 50 from Hezbollah, at least 50 from Hezbollah earlier on in the week. So we'll just multiply that, 100,000 by 350. That's 35 million. Just spent in this week alone defending Israeli airspace. 35 million. That is unsustainable rate of loss. And these is, again, low-balled numbers, you know. That's unsustainable. That is mathematically unsustainable. And it sort of blew my mind. Because I'm like, because you take it for granted that the economy also plays a factor in war, but it's like, oh, right. It takes money to make these weapons, and one of us is spending more money than the other guy. And Iran's not that guy. Israel is the one spending more than it ever should be on these types of weapons. And they're going to run into a wall. Either they're going to run out of the money, you know, to pay for it, or they're going to run out of the missiles. And there's not anywhere near enough missiles to go around. Like, the global market on air defense missiles is tapped out. Like, no one who has them is selling what they have, and the people who were selling them are tapped out. The United States, Europe, NATO, they're tapped out because of Ukraine. Right, which is another reason why all this talk about the United States needs to stand by Israel is stupid, because it acts as though the Israel war was happening in a vacuum. A vacuum where we didn't empty out our arsenals for Ukraine. Now, let's say defending Israel was something that the United States needed to do. It's not, but let's say that it was. It would still be a bad idea to do that after emptying your arsenals in another war that's still ongoing. The Ukraine war is still ongoing. We cleaned house. We're out of 155mm artillery shells. We cleaned out all of our air defense missiles. Well, not all of them, obviously, but a significant chunk of them. They went to Ukraine, and they're being used up by the Ukrainians right now to defend their airspace. We don't have the resources to defend Israel right now. And so that, you know, factoring in the context with the wider global context with which the war in Palestine is happening right now between Israel and Palestine, it, you know, when you factor in the context of a Ukraine war that we emptied our arsenals for into the equation, it, defending Israel becomes an even dumber idea than it actually is. Well, an even dumber idea than it was before, at least for the United States. Other countries, it might be worth your while, but for the United States, it's not. And even if it was, we went all in on Ukraine. We don't have the resources to defend Israel right now. Don't have the resources. And they're going to need air defense. They were begging us for air defense missiles at the beginning of this round of fighting with you know, Hamas, because they knew that they'd run into this problem that I've just talked about eventually. They're going to run out, or they're going to run out of money. Now, I don't think that they'll run out of the money, but they're definitely going to run out of the rockets. And what happens then? It's game over. It's game over. Because I can guarantee you that Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, all the regional militias in Iraq and Syria, I can guarantee you they have more rockets than Israel has Iron Dome missiles. I can guarantee you. When Israel runs out, it's over. It's over, because that means that the other side can strike with impunity at any target they want to in Israel. Which means that Israel, at that point, will be in checkmate. Israel is going to, in the coming months, Israel is going to start running into one checkmate after the next. All their pawns and all their pieces are being removed from the board systematically. And they're going to be in a position where it's going to be down to the king. It's going to be down to the king. If they go left, check. If they go right, diagonal, check. If they go left, diagonal, check. If they go backwards a space, check. If they go to the right, check. Back right, check. Back left, check. If they stay still, check. Israel's about to get put in check in the coming months, and the running out of their air defense missiles is another way in which they will be put into check. And it's going to be game over. Now, if they accept their defeat, or if they leave this shit alone while they still have the chance, they can avoid that. And they can walk away with just, a little bit of dignity left. If they don't, they're facing the abolition of Israel as a consequence and as a price for trying to abolish Palestine. It'd be the greatest irony of this war that they set out to destroy Palestine and destroyed themselves in the process and create, and then on their own ashes, a Palestinian state was established. That'll be the greatest irony of this war. Again, Israel still has all the time in the world to avoid that. Not all the time in the world. They're running out of time. They're on the clock, but they still have plenty of time. But will they? I don't think so. But yeah. Big attack. Could have been worse. Everyone knows that it could have been worse. The Iranians could have said faster, stronger, more powerful rockets. I mean, word on the street is that the Iranians have hypersonics. Like, come on now. If they really wanted to, they could have turned, because there was a talk about how the Iranians hit this port in Israel. Oh, they hit this port. If they wanted to, they could have turned that port into a dry dock. That's the power of a hypersonic missile. But they didn't. They chose the path of restraint. They are still choosing the path of, the path of most resistance, to be frank with you. Iran is still choosing the path of most resistance. Because the path of least resistance would have been to just give in and start the war. The path of most resistance is to sit there and say, no, we're not going to go to war with you. And that takes a lot of patience. And I'll make a comparison to Civ 5 here. I wouldn't have anyone near as much patience as the Iranians do. I have started wars in that game for so much less. But the Iranians have a lot of patience. Even now, when they were put in a position where they had to respond, and there was talk that it was going to be big, it was going to be powerful, and, it would flatten a lot of things in Israel. Even now, they are still choosing the path of restraint. They're still choosing the path of most resistance to avoid a wider war. To avoid a direct confrontation with Israel. And to avoid a war that they can win. To be straightforward. A war that they can win. They're avoiding a war that they can win on behalf of the countries that they would defeat in said war. And that is a level of patience that is commendable. Like, for whether you like Iran's government or not, when you realize that they are a force of restraint in this region, and that they're continuing to be a force of restraint, even in the face of such a clear and deliberate provocation against them, an act of war, bombing of their embassy, to see that they are still holding on and still being that force of restraint, and for Israel's sake, mind you, they have their own reasons, obviously, their own interests, but the irony being that Iran's interest in restraining the regional powers and the regional militias actually lines up with Israel's interests. But Israel is too slow and too politically motivated to see that and to take advantage of that and to leave the Iranians alone. So it's impressive. It is an impressive display of patience. You gotta give them that. Right. Impressive display of patience. They've given Israel the olive branch. They gave them a slap on the wrist for bombing their embassy when they had every right to just go all in on the war. And who could have said anything about it? Israel bombed the consulate. Who could have said anything about it? Nobody. You can't. That's international law. You bombed someone's sovereign territory. They had every right to go to war. They chose not to. And thank goodness that they didn't. The olive branch is out. both sides can take this and claim a victory. Both sides can walk away from this. But will they? Iran will if they have the chance. But that chance depends on Israel. Because, again, Israel and all her fake friends are talking about needing to respond to Iran's response, as if they were themselves were not responsible for incurring said response. It's insane. It's truly wild. But I was thinking about talking about the reawakening of America's Christian identity, you know, because that's another sort of trend that I'm watching happening in America. But I think I'm gonna save that for when Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro have the debate, because I know that one's coming. So, can't wait to talk about that one. Yeah, but I'll just give you a brief overview before we sign out, because, like, all this talk of, are you loyal to Israel? You know, we have to stand by Israel. We have to stand by them. Oh, if you say that Christ is king here, that's anti-Semitic. All these attacks on Christianity and on America's Christian identity, and the questioning of America's loyalties to a nation that happens to be Jewish, is instigating a reawakening of America's Christian identity that has been very peculiar to watch. I mean, even Trump has got in on this. He's made the America Bible. The America Bible. And he's actually in the process laying the groundwork for the American civilization. Because a civilization is not complete without its religion. And Trump is now, he's made his own Bible. He's made his own Bible. But this is great. This is great. But yeah, we're watching with the revival of America's national identity as a country in North America, in opposition to America's imperial identity. That is now being overlaid with the resurrection of America's Christian identity as well. Like I say it all the time, this is the second American Revolution, but we're watching yet another avenue with which that revolutionary energy is being channeled. The reawakening of religion in America, which was a very unintended consequence of this war in Palestine. Who would have thought that would be the thing to bring America, that and Trump, of all people, would be the ones to bring America back to God? I mean, I'm not complaining, but it's just, you know, unexpected. Welcome, but unexpected. When I get the chance to, I'll talk more about that. But alas, my lovely listeners, that is all I have for you today. I finally managed to get a shorter episode in. I won't talk you to death for nearly 2 hours. But yeah, a lot happening with Israel and Iran sort of stole the show for the entire week, you know. But we'll have a lot to talk about next week. We'll see if Israel does something stupid this week. I'm sure that they will, but the degree and the severity of which will remain to be seen. Of course, they're always trying to drag us into their war. This is why you don't let the tail wag the dog. This is why you don't hand out blank checks. I mean, for all the obsession with learning the lessons of World War II, people really forgot about the lessons of World War I. The lessons of World War I are that alliances don't serve. Alliances that you just sit on don't help you. Right. The military alliances exist for wars. Military alliances exist to fight wars. And that was a lesson from the First World War that has been completely forgotten in favor of today's status quo, where America has a half a trillion alliances everywhere. And then we wonder why these allies, you know, drag us into wars every time. You know, if I had a superpower there to fight my battles for me too, shit, I'd be willing to start a war with a bigger neighbor as well. Why wouldn't I? You're gonna fight my wars for me. We're allies. You're my ally. You're gonna fight for me, aren't you? Oh, you wouldn't abandon your, you know. We've learned nothing from the century of scams, but that is a topic for another day. But alas, my lovely listeners, that is all I have for you today. I do hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast on my geopolitical podcast. The world is changing, folks, and we are going to have fun watching that change together. And I've been your host, Hashan Wade, and you've been listening to This Week in Geopolitics. So till we meet again next Monday, Servus.